The wall of the war on terror. Let's read a passage from the article by Mark McKinnon. The fence makes for nervous neighbors. In 2004, the International Court of Justice at The Hague ruled the barrier was illegal and called for Israel to tear it down and compensate those whose lives were adversely affected by it. The ruling, however, generated sparse international reaction beyond the Arab world. With the backing of Israel's own Supreme Court, construction continues apace. The only wrangling now is over the final route. The barrier is in parts a Berlin-style concrete wall, as at the Anata schoolyard, which we've seen the pictures of, and in others a metal fence supplemented by a system of trenches, motion sensors, and security roads. The Israeli government views it as an unqualified success, pointing to a sharp decline in the number of suicide bombers who have reached Israeli cities since the barriers began to go up. The Israeli army says that there were 73 suicide bombings or car bombings, killing 293 Israelis between the start of the Intifada in the fall of 2000 and the commencement of the barrier's construction in July of 2003. So is this wall legal, according to a court in The Hague, an international court in The Hague? It isn't legal. And this question of, if I can go back to the document camera, the rule of law, that's going to be a major theme throughout this course. We have in the world sovereign governments, sovereign states. Let me do that again. Sovereign states. In 1945, when the United Nations was created, there were 50 countries. Today, there are 200 countries recognized in the world as sovereign in international law. Where did the 150 countries, and I'm speaking in approximations, where did these 150 new countries come from? Well, these are the European empires, the imperial governments which ruled, which made decisions for indigenous peoples. But after World War II, it was increasingly difficult to support that. It was intellectually increasingly difficult, morally increasingly difficult, and Europe was just exhausted. Europe had kind of spent itself with its own internal clash in World War I and World War II. And one of the very big issues that I think we'll want to address is, well, was this process of decolonization resulting from the dismantling of European empires, did that result in independent sovereign peoples assuming their own self-government, or did a new kind of empire take shape and take form? And did the United States, and to some extent the Soviet Union, move into this vacuum of power created by the dismantling of European empires? And, well, of course, in 1953-1954, Masada in Iran tried to take over the Anglo-Iranian oil company, tried to nationalize it, tried to assert the sovereign jurisdiction of the Iranians over Iranian oil. Kermit Roosevelt was sent in with, literally with a suitcase with $1 million in it to pay off people and to take out Masada, and that's exactly what happened. The Shah of Iran was put in place as a kind of puppet to see that the oil flowed to the sources that the United States and Britain had negotiated between themselves. And that was so insulting to the Iranian people that eventually in 1979 they rose up in revolt and affirmed the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime. And there was a popular uprising, but it wasn't a communist revolution. Communism being founded on the principle that religion is the opiate of the people. It's historic materialism. The essence of human history comes in the struggle for resources and ownership and control. And Marx was intensely secular, was atheistic, and felt that religion was simply exploited by the ruling class as a way to keep people kind of docile. Oh, don't worry, you might have a hard life now and you might not be treated fairly now, but if you're good, you'll go to heaven. Don't worry, you're going to have eternity of paradise. That's how Marx looked at it. But obviously, we might have thought in the West that the world was becoming increasingly secular and that this was inevitable, that churches would become less and less powerful, and that the concept that, we use our reason, we don't, that essentially our destiny and fate will be determined by our application of reasonable thought as opposed to divine intervention, as opposed to all of history and destiny being controlled by God or a group of gods. And of course, who is the legitimate God is a huge point of contention in the world. So the revolution in Iran in 1979 has had, that when we look back in history, we're going to see that as a very, very major event, one of the major events of the 20th century. So this question of sovereignty is closely connected to the question of the rule of law. Do we as human beings, is it all about survival of the fittest? Is it just a struggle for power where those who are capable of asserting power, whether it be through coercion or intimidation or the use of arms, the use of strength, is that going to be the way decisions are made? And I would say that if there is such a thing as civilization, and there is, civilization has depended upon the idea, no, we're going to make our decisions based on some rules, and we're going to apply some rational procedures. We're going to set up courts. We're going to try to avoid violence when possible and come up with alternatives. And these courts and these procedures are going to have some universal principles, so that everybody has to go through this, and we're going to treat this as everybody's subject to it. But of course, that is rarely happens. There's always an elite group who are able to bend the rules or make the rules, and yet surely democracy, if there is such a thing as a democracy, that is an effort to counteract that, to say, no, there's got to be some universal principles that apply uniformly. So we've here and there done this in an imperfect and incomplete way within the construct of nation states, but within the realm of international law, the totality of humanity, we haven't got anywhere close to that. Although we're touching at the edges of it. That's what we're doing right here, right now, I think. We created a League of Nations, or our ancestors created a League of Nations. Interestingly, the founder of the League of Nations, the person who proposed it, Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president, who said he's bringing the military of the United States into World War I, and he's not doing it to support one imperialism over another imperialism. He said, well, we're doing it for the self-determination of peoples. We're going to take our democratic liberal principles from the United States, and we're going to bring all the world has these principles. But there is, in the United States, a certain isolationism, a certain sense, no, we make our rules here, we make our laws here, we're not going to have anybody tell us what to do. Certainly, you know, the fact that the United States kept slavery until 1862, this was very contrary to what was going on in Europe and much of the rest of the world. The British Empire banned the slave trade in 1807, abolished slavery in 1832. The United States kept it until 1862. This is part of a process whereby the United States says, mind your own business. We will make these decisions within our own domestic framework. And slavery was obviously an issue that lent itself to international law, to international principles. The other great issue was, well, as the United States pushes west, there are people there. There are ancient societies living there. Indigenous peoples live there. And the United States was very adamant. Our Western expansion is not your business, Great Britain. It's not an international matter. We're domesticating this within our own society. So the United States has this history where, in a sense, it wants to be involved in the world, and it has these moments, but then it pulls back upon itself. But we don't want the world deciding for us. So the United Nations was definitely a creation of the United States. Basically a creation of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had the New Deal. And in a sense, the United Nations was an expansion of the idea of the New Deal. And the United Nations is all we have as a world government. And we can see now that the United States is very cautious of the powers of the United Nations. Although the United Nations is, in a way, an outgrowth of the United States' policies, it has its headquarters in the United States in New York. But, you know, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was in hostility to, or in contradiction of, the rules of the United Nations. It didn't have the approval of the Security Council of the United Nations. And theoretically, if there is such a thing as international law, there is a way to do legal warfare, but you have to have the sanction of the Security Council of the United States. The Security Council gave the sanction to the intervention in Korea in the early 1950s. The Security Council gave a sanction to George Bush Sr.'s Iraq War in 1991. So it is known to happen that the Security Council will do that. Now, of course, what is the Security Council? The Security Council is the victors of World War II. And, you know, it's not a very democratic, it's in no way representative of humanity. It's representative of the powerful governments that govern part of humanity. So, you know, we need to consider the United Nations, and the United Nations is subject to all kinds of reforms if it was going to become more democratic. But right now, the United States is essentially taking the position, we're the highest authority. We trump the United Nations. Is it the UN or the US? And the US has the weaponry. The US has an incredibly elaborate military-industrial complex, and essentially is in a position to say to anybody and everybody, nobody can tell us what to do. And in fact, we have the power to destroy you if you don't do what we want you to do. And the United States is demonstrating right now it's willing to use those instruments. And of course, as the United States goes into debt to China primarily, started with Japan, now it's $60 billion a month. It's extraordinary. There is a very close connection between the rise of Walmart and the industrial situation, the economic situation in China. Things are no longer made in North America. They're manufactured elsewhere, where you can pay lower wages, where you can you don't have the same labor legislation. This is having a consequence. So the United States, which used to control so much of the global economy, is losing that control. as they lose that control, the military power that they have and that they're developing, and that they're going into debt to create, the temptation grows to fall back on that as an instrument. So the rule of law is my segue into some discussion about the internet. The internet is obviously subject to some form of laws and regulations. It works. It couldn't work if there wasn't a protocol, if there wasn't certain standards. But who is the sovereign of the internet? Does the internet have a sovereign? So I'm going to suggest that the internet, in a way, becomes the new frontier of this issue of relations between people. Now, every institution needs to have a website. And as an institution comes up with their websites, what are we going to put on it? We're going to have to say what we stand for, what our mission is. If there's a crisis that comes up, we're going to have to say what our position is. So it ends up that many, many things get negotiated on the internet. There's a story to give the internet a history now. And we are the web. This is an interesting magazine called Wired. And according to this magazine, the internet has had its 10th anniversary. 10 years ago, Netscape's explosive IPO. Anybody know what IPO is? Initial public offering. So shares, you're putting your company on the stock market. 10 years ago, Netscape's explosive IPO ignited huge piles of money. The brilliant flash revealed what had been inevitable only a moment before: the World Wide Web, as Eric Schmidt, then at Sun, now at Google, noted. The day before the IPO, nothing about the web. The day after, everything. Computing pioneer Vannevar Bush outlined the web's core idea, hyperlinked pages, in 1945. So the web, the initial thought was, well, it's just going to be business. It's just going to be companies using it to do business. But according to this, one study found that only 40% of the web is commercial. The deep enthusiasm for making things, for interacting more deeply than just choosing options, is the great force not reckoned 10 years ago. And I think this is a huge surprise. Could we talk about the internet as, in a sense, a gift economy? I mean, the reality is that people want to create things. They want to use the internet to communicate. Why? Because we're human beings, and it's compelling and engaging to communicate. And so it turns out that the internet is giving all kinds of people an opening to do their art, to make their statements, to create their blogs, to do what we're doing here and now. Why are they doing it? It's a gift economy. You know, in a sense, perhaps it's a kind of almost a socialist utopia. You know, you give into it what you can, you take from it what you need, So this was an unexpected, I think. Page 132. Here's an interesting. The soldiers in Iraq are blogging. Logs of War. Here's an interesting image. We've never had a war situation where you can actually hear directly from the soldiers in that war. So in a sovereign country, there's the concept of citizenship. Citizenship has rights and responsibilities. Citizenship is a very, very important concept. Some think that our identity as citizens is sort of being overwhelmed by our identity as consumers. So here's an interesting phrase, netizens. What are you on the internet? How are you governed? What is the system? Netizens. What matters is the network of social creation, the community of collaborative interaction, interactivity. Remember, I talked about oceans and wind as a media of interactivity. What is the media of interactivity? Money is a kind of medium of interactivity. Even money now, what is money now? Money is digital information going around the planet. Money is digitalized. Money is just another form of information. What is value in the economy, the political economy of the internet? How do you add value? The rules are just in flux. So, what now?